Well, that has given us all a lot of food for thought. But we now move on to the second part of the proceeding, which is the question and answer session. Ideally, pose a question and the panel will try and answer, but by all means make a comment if you don't want to ask a question. There will be roving mics. What would be helpful is if you could stand up, give your name, and then, as it were, your professional background. Yes.
Not just the petitioner in unclear or children cases. left in the game. And I just think that's a little bit haphazard. And perhaps looking at the practice direction from instruction to prevent too many courses would be a good idea.
The reality, I'm afraid, is we are where we are. And I suspect most people in this room take the view that we are in a very bad position. But that, I'm afraid, is reality. The complexity of making the process compulsory was vividly illustrated yesterday. When the Family Procedure Rules Committee is considering the detail of rules as from next April, found itself facing some very, very fundamental, very, very difficult questions in relation to which the views of the Rules Committee were not easily accommodated within government policy. Say, why can't we have a practice direction tomorrow? I think implicit in your question, which is why I'm answering it, is the suggestion I should be doing something about it. I will throw the challenge back to you. You provide me with a draft practice direction, which would enable us to move forward on that route in advance of April, and I'll consider it. The issues, I'm afraid, when one gets to grips with the technicalities, and unhappily there are technicalities, which are very, very difficult in terms of making this process compulsory, within the ambit of the existing arrangements, within the reality of no legal aid, within the reality of all the other problems we're facing, are, I'm afraid, very considerable. And quite apart from anything else, I think it's a topic on which I'd be ill-advised to issue unilaterally a practice direction without some form of consultation. And that process, being where it is fit, we are where we are, is going to take quite some, will take quite some time.
Can I possibly come back on that very
Three times this year, I have been asked to run workshops at civil mediation type organisations, so the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators, CMC, and the FMA. And at each place, I have put forward the proposal that we have a huge problem with our whole dispute resolution system, because regularly, in fact, it has become completely normal, the costs of both parties added together well exceed the value of the dispute. And this is particularly the case in media, in family cases, where they're mostly only arguing over 10 or 20%, and the costs are multiples of that on many occasions. So my suggestion would be that the judges are encouraged to look at the probable value of the dispute in relation to the costs, and are asked to encourage people to go for mediation assessment once the costs reach 20% of the value of the dispute or thereabouts, and are given even greater encouragement to go once the costs get to half. I do not think that anybody could say that that was a negligent thing to do. It would be quite a prudent thing to do, because you'd be, the clients themselves would understand that the judges were trying to prevent all their assets being used up in costs. And so that is what I am arguing for in relation to family and civil disputes, because I think something needs to happen.
Thank you. Yes.
My name is Marion Roberts, and I'm a mediator, having practiced and been continuous practice for 30 years. The first thing I'd like to say is that the purpose of mediation, and for mediation to be fit for purpose, is that it serves a consensual decision-making process. And that's not to be confused with all the very real problematic and contradictory implications that Christina has highlighted. What I would like to ask is, mediation in my view, is an alternative not to the court but to lawyer negotiation. And that is a very serious problem at the moment. When people are not suitable for mediation, they don't want to necessarily go to court. They want to have good partisan lawyers to represent them. That has been seriously curtailed, and that is the real problem. But I'd like to ask Liz Trinder, if I may, what research has been done on lawyer negotiation? The only research that I'm aware of is that by Carol Menkel-Meadow in North America. But we are not able to compare the efficacy of mediation unless you compare it not with litigation and court and adjudication, but with lawyer negotiation. My understanding is no research has been done in this country. I've got other things to say, but I'll shut up.
Well, my colleague Anne Barlow is currently conducting a major study with Rosie Hunter at Kent that compares mediation and lawyer system negotiations and collaborative law. It's primarily a qualitative study, that element, but that's already producing some very interesting findings. They're really trying to understand what the experiences are of the clients of those different processes. So I think that's going to be coming out in about a year's time. But there is very limited research. I mean, most of the comparison is with litigation rather than just negotiation. And they're very different processes and different clients.
Can I just add to that? Which is, I think, an additional point to the one you're making, that mediation, I think this is I hope universally supported, works best when it is properly supported by good and focused legal advice. And obviously, for many people in this country, that opportunity has now disappeared. So it has obviously led to a reduction in mediation, and I wonder if it's actually led, as I said, that we have anecdotal evidence, but nothing more than that at this stage, led to less successful mediation processes. I suspect it has, so it's a double whammy.